Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you've tuned in. We're on Twitter at KUOW. A former campaign manager for President Trump says he's not guilty of money laundering. Paul Manafort and his business partner Rick Gates were both indicted this morning by the special prosecutor investigating Russian interference with the presidential election. The White House says the indictment news has got nothing to do with Russian collusion.
Today's announcement has nothing to do with the president, has nothing to do with the president's campaign or campaign activity. The real collusion scandal, as we've said several times before, has everything to do with the Clinton campaign, Fusion GPS, and Russia.
Here to tell you what today's events might mean is Washington Post on-air reporter Libby Casey. Libby, thanks for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
This special counsel investigation is supposed to be about collusion with Russia to swing the election. So I guess the spokesperson for the White House has a good question. What does money laundering and the other charges against Paul Manafort have to do with Trump or his campaign or collusion?
The special counsel has the ability to really go wherever the crimes or the suspicion of crimes go. So we see here these two individuals who were involved in the campaign charged with everything from laundering money, but also conspiracy against the U.S. and making false statements. And there are a lot of questions about not just what Paul Manafort did before he got involved with the Trump campaign, but there are still remaining questions about what he did as part of the campaign and whether or not it touched on the issue of collusion with Russia, helping a foreign government, Russia, meddle with the election.
Yes, you mentioned conspiracy and false statements. I have heard about false statements allegedly, to hide taxable money. But are we talking about so far anything more than that? Does this touch the alleged collusion scandal at all?
Yeah, that's a great question. At this point, this is really focused on what Paul Manafort and Rick Gates, who was a longtime business partner of him and a deputy of him, what they did over the years to take money, hide money, and they had ties with the Ukrainian government and basically were acting as foreign agents and didn't file the paperwork, didn't do due diligence and divulge that. But that does not mean that this probe isn't going to the other area of collusion. So far, no charges directly with these men along those lines, but everyone is wondering, you know, where this probe will go and if Robert Mueller, the special counsel, will be able to leverage these charges, use these charges to get more information out of these individuals. There's something, Bill, that we have to focus on today, too. A former advisor to the Trump campaign, George Papadopoulos, a name that most people have never even heard of before, pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI. Now, that was unsealed today. We learned about it today, even though he was arrested back in July over the summer. But you know, this is a minor player, someone who was an advisor to the president in foreign policy. But he is someone we're really watching because what he has admitted to, and we see this in the paperwork that's been released, he was trying to basically set up meetings between the Trump campaign and the Russians. Now, this does not prove that the Trump campaign was agreeing to that or was excited about that. But this is going to be a very key piece of information to look at because the documents that we saw today say that Papadopoulos was basically trying to set up these meetings and someone in the campaign knew about it. And so it raises a lot more questions about how involved the campaign officials were.
Okay, so watch Papadopoulos as well as Manafort and Gates. Meanwhile, you heard the White House spokesperson bringing up the Clinton campaign. We've been hearing about her campaign and the Democratic National Committee funding opposition research that may have had something to do with the infamous salacious Steele dossier. What is your take on where all of that stands and how much we should be paying attention?
I certainly don't want to say that it's not newsworthy, but at this point, this is a huge news story today, what's happening here in Washington with two former campaign people being indicted and going before, you know, the courts and then having to plead not guilty. There's talk of whether or not they would have a bond of $10 million and $5 million. The Mueller investigation made a huge step forward today when we learned of these indictments and also the guilty plea by George Papadopoulos. So I think we can't get distracted from this crucial news story. I mean, this this is really a significant development, and the White House certainly has important points to make in terms of just how important these men were or were not, and that certainly is something that Robert Mueller is looking into. So we can't dismiss the White House perspective, but talking about the Clinton campaign certainly does seem like a distraction at this point.
Fair enough. Finally, Libby Casey from Washington Post, how worried do you think President Trump ought to be? How happy should his most ardent opponents be? That's how a lot of us take bits of news like this. We just want to know, if you can't stand President Trump, you want to know, did we just move closer to impeachment, farther away from impeachment? What's the big picture take?
Yeah, I think the reality of this is it is an ongoing process. We're only 5 months into this Mueller investigation, and this will be a story that, you know, years from now we'll be able to look at and fast forward, and it will all make sense. But right now we're living it day to day, and this is one more piece of the puzzle. I don't think that the Trump administration is running scared, but I do think that there are a lot of people wondering just who was talking to George Papadopoulos and why he was trying to set up these meetings between the Russians and the Trump campaign. He thought that he had dirt on Hillary Clinton. Does that sound familiar, Bill?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all know that just a couple months later, members of the Trump team, including one of his sons, met with some Russians to try to get this, you know, so-called dirt. Or, you know, so there are some concerns. And the Washington Post did a story today looking at what we're reading from the Mueller investigation so far. And a lot of prosecutors talked to our reporters and said, you know, this just shows Manafort's not messing around. Mueller is not messing around. And the fact that these indictments are coming down on the same day that we're learning about a guilty plea is a signal to everyone involved in this that Mueller is taking this seriously, that he is pushing forward hard, and that this probe is really just getting started.
Reading signals for you is reporter, on-air reporter for The Washington Post, Libby Casey. Libby, thanks for helping us make sense of a fast-moving story out of D.C. We appreciate it. Let's talk again.
Thank you.
KUOW's The Record, continuing in a moment. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We talk about how many women were raped last year, not how many men raped women. We talk about how many girls in a school district were harassed last year, not about how many boys harassed girls. That is the beginning of a longer quote, a couple of paragraphs long, that has gone viral on social media over the last couple of weeks in the wake of the news about film producer Harvey Weinstein sexually assaulting and harassing actresses and women co-workers for years. The argument from that quote is, because we talk about sexual assault and violence against women in a passive way where we only mention the victim and never the perpetrator, we absolve those perpetrators, those men, of responsibility. It's from a talk by Jackson Katz, the author of the book The Macho Paradox and co-founder of Mentors in Violence Prevention. Jackson Katz, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
When we talk about sexual assault, why do we use that passive voice?
Well, it's just one of the many ways in which social norms work to maintain a certain status quo. And the status quo is men have been in charge and men have been dominant in our society and virtually every society for centuries. And the way, one of the ways in which that dominance takes shape and form is through language. And the lack of accountability in language is an important part of the shift that has to happen if we want to prevent these pathetically common incidents from happening over and over again.
I had thought it was partly because one male perpetrator probably has many victims, so it's less helpful to talk about how many perpetrators there are. We'll say one in five women, etc.
Well, I mean, that's an important secondary point, I think. I mean, that's a point that for journalists and methodologists and quantitative sociologists, and of course, there is not a one-to-one relationship between perpetration and victimization. But if you look at the patterns in language across a range of these type of topics, you'll see over and over again that the lack of accountability is a very important function of how language plays out. I mean, this is true with race as well. We talk when a person of color is charged with a crime, we often see that person identified by their race. But if it's a white person, it's often the race isn't mentioned. This is very common in linguistics, how what's called the unmarked member of the linguistic pair tends to be the one that is the dominant one. So, for example, men are typically not marked with a gender. Men are supposed to be the universal human subject. Women are the ones who have a gender. And, again, the way that that plays out in real life is when we talk about, say, sexual assault or, quote-unquote, violence against women, the term violence against women itself is a passive construction. It's a passive phrase. There's no active agent in the sentence. Nobody's doing it to women. They're just experiencing it. And, again, you can't see these patterns as anything other than the playing out of power, because it's not a coincidence.
You write that the burden of changing the culture of abuse should not be on the shoulders of survivors. How is that burden on the shoulders of survivors now? We've talked about language, but help me understand how that burden falls.
Well, just survivors have been the ones, for example, on college campuses, you know, sexual assault survivors who have been driving the sort of public conversation, pushing campus administrations and the federal government to a certain extent, although the federal government has recently retreated from this, pushing them to take seriously the issue of sexual violence. And it shouldn't be on the shoulders of the person who suffered. They shouldn't be the ones who have to change systems and hold powerful people accountable. They're just trying to survive what has happened to them. I think people in positions of leadership are the ones who are responsible for changing the culture, for changing the practices that lead to these abuses, not the people who have been the targets. Obviously, the people who are the survivors and the targets have an important role to play, and they have played an important role from the beginning of the domestic and sexual violence movements in the 1970s. But it's not their responsibility. It's the responsibility of the powerful.
What should men be doing to dismantle this culture?
Well, one thing, Bill, is I define these issues as leadership issues for men. It's not just individual men or young men. It's men in positions of institutional leadership, cultural authority, and influence. Men at all levels of leadership, whether it's in their family, faith, community, politics, business, education, sports. Men are in so many positions of influence in our society, cutting across class and race and ethnicity. And a lot of men just have been a bit AWOL on these subjects. And they've just thought, okay, this is a women's issue. It's a women's concern. Or the most that I'll do is I'll support the women that I know. I'll donate some money to a battered women's program, or I'll privately give comfort to my woman close to me who's been a survivor of sexual violence or domestic. And I appreciate all that, but that's not enough. I think we need men in positions of institutional leadership to say, this is going to become a priority, and I'm going to use whatever platform of influence I have to work with women, not against them. And imagine if all the men who have positions of influence in our society were to say, you know what, I'm going to try to figure out how I can leverage that influence and make it so that in the male culture that I have sway over, I'm going to make it clear that abusing women in any way, verbally, emotionally, physically, sexually, is completely unacceptable. And by the way, not just extreme acts of violence like rape and you know, punches in the face. I'm talking about the sexism and the casual day-to-day abuses that a lot of men who are good men nonetheless engage in.
And I thought it was interesting, Jackson, you said you've been using the word leadership. You said this is not a sensitivity training. That phrase is an eye roller for some people. And you said that it's not working. Sensitivity training is not what it's about. It's about leadership. Will you explain that difference?
Sure. I mean, I think that's another important shift in a conceptual shift. I don't think we need more men who are more sensitive, although sensitivity is a good thing. I don't think that's what we need. I think we need more men who act as responsible individuals, as responsible professionals, and those who are leaders, they need to act as better leaders. We live in a very diverse, gender and sexually diverse and racially and ethnically diverse society in the 21st century, and if you're going around acting in ways that are oppressive to people, say to women if you're a man, or to people of color if you're a white person, not only are you doing something that's wrong, harmful, and potentially criminal, you're also, if you're in a position of leadership, being a bad leader, because we do live in a diverse society. Look at all the workplaces just in the last several months that have had sexual harassment scandals erupt, in whether it's Fox News or Uber or in the tech industry, several other companies, the United States military. I mean, it's just on and on with these workplaces where sexual harassment has been going on. There's been abusive behavior. Some men have turned their head, or if you will, enabled the behavior by not saying anything. Some of them are coming forward now and saying, I wish I had said something, or I feel like a jerk because I didn't say something. I appreciate that that's an honest way to, it's an honest thing for men to say. And men at all levels, I think, have had that experience. But again, it's time to change the paradigm. And so talking about leadership and emphasizing that, you know, it takes strength and self-confidence on the part of a man to challenge and interrupt other men. It doesn't, it's not a measure of how soft a man is or how he's being politically correct. It's a measure of his character and his strength if he has the, what it takes to challenge and interrupt other men's sexism.
Yeah, well, you're talking, it sounds like a recognition of men typically responding to words like strength and self-confidence and leadership rather than sensitivity. Are we giving up on that idea? Are we reinforcing some notions and dealing with what we've got when it comes to how men, what men respond to?
It's a good question. I would say that it's both, because I think it is true that moral courage and strength is real. It's not fake, and I think men and women have it equally, by the way. So this is not when we talk about strength, we're not talking about some kind of reinforcing of some traditional masculine chest thumping strength. We're talking about expanding that definition. And I think one of the problems in our society at large and the world at large, to be blunt about it, is that so many men are invested, and so many women to a certain extent are invested in this idea that men's strength resides in their physical ability to dominate. When in fact, to me, strength is about more about moral courage. Yes, physical courage too, but moral courage. And women have just as much moral courage, obviously, as men do. So in that sense, we're not saying we're reinscribing some kind of traditional and discredited notion of you know, patriarchal power. I think it's a positive quality.
Do you expect men to more and more come out and confess their own sexual harassment, abuse, even rape?
That's a little dicey, because I've been doing this work with men, and my colleagues have in multiracial, multi-ethnic environments for a long, long time. It's very rare that you'll have men talk about their behavior. Sometimes they do, if their behavior is either really, really disreputable or in some cases criminal. And so I don't think we need this mass confessional. I mean, I think there's, it's healthy to hear men come forward and talk honestly about their behavior, absolutely, but I think it's unrealistic to think it's going to be a mass movement. I think what's more likely is men saying, you know what, I think I have in the past been silent. In some cases, maybe I've even participated in behavior that I'm not proud of. They don't not necessarily have to enumerate that in front of, you know, and self-flagellate. I don't think that that's necessarily realistic or even constructive in every case. I mean, obviously, if they feel the need to do that, I think it's a good thing. But I think what's more likely and more beneficial is if more men say, okay, I'm going to learn from, I'm listening to this Me Too hashtag, I'm listening to the women around me and all over the world saying how much they've experienced harassment and abuse. I feel like I'm a man of integrity. I don't want to be participating in this system that harms so many people, including women close to me and men close to me and young men and women. And I'm going to start trying to do better. And I'm going to look for models for other men as well as women who can show me, you know, how to improve my, you know, behavior. I mean, it's basic stuff here. It's like golden rule stuff, right? I mean, we're not talking about asking people to do some radical shift here. It's just basically treat others with respect and dignity as you would hope to be treated. And when you think that you might be acting in ways that are oppressive, then, you know, have the courage to be introspective, and then have the courage to do whatever it takes to change. And then if you're in a position of influence, don't just keep it to yourself. You have to be proactive. And again, I would say, Bill, it's just very similar to racism and white people. If you're a white person and you feel like it's absolutely wrong that racism is still an ever-present phenomenon in the United States, which it is, and you feel like that's the country is not living up to its best ideals, and you're in a position as a white person to, you know, to challenge and interrupt racism and work towards a racially just, you know, society, then do it. I mean, it's the same thing with gender justice, and it's the same thing with heterosexuals who are concerned with sexual justice. Pretty basic stuff.
On the topic of violence against women, do you want violent men to feel more shame? Do we need more shame?
I don't think shame. I think responsibility. I think shame is generally a destructive emotion, and I think shame underlies a huge amount of the violence that men commit in the world, because what men often do with shame is, you know, they feel like something's been taken from them, their honor, their dignity, and in many cases, what violent men do is they act out violently to take back what has been taken from them, and they want to reclaim some kind of sense of themselves as men. So shame can often result in really bad behavior. In fact, school shootings, mass killings are often have their roots in shame experienced by men. We could even talk about whole societies and how terrorism is often a function of the dispossession and degradation of a people. The young men of those people feel a sense of shame, collective shame, and they're gonna wash away the shame through acts of redemptive violence. So shame is definitely a problematic emotion. So no, I wouldn't say that we need to shame them. I think that we do need to have a sense of accountability and responsibility. And men who have committed violence in the past, in illegitimate ways, when I say illegitimate, not self-defense or not defense of others, but other forms of aggressive violence, I think need to say, you know, to have a reckoning and say, how can I be a better person and how can I be a better man? And not necessarily, we don't necessarily just have to gang up on them even further, but we do have to hold them accountable and responsible.
One more question, Jackson Katz, author of The Macho Paradox. You've spent a lot of time in macho cultures, so to speak, the military, sports. What is it that's going to change that men in those, as you say, macho environments are going to start showing the leadership you mentioned? That's not okay. That's not funny. This is my story. These are the people we love. What could change? You've been around these folks.
Sure. I mean, what's going to change is when the system, if you will, holds people accountable for not acting in those ways, and when leaders within those systems make it clear that the only way to advance in those systems, in other words, in the military, the only way you're going to get promoted, the only way you're going to be successful is if you treat others with respect and you challenge and interrupt others when they are treating others with disrespect. And if once that becomes embedded in the sort of ethos of the institution, and then it's acted on by powerful people, and systems are responsive to those kinds of beliefs. Until that happens, if we're just going to isolate individuals and try to make individuals better, but the system itself just turns the other cheek or looks the other way or promotes people who are acting abusively, we have a problem on our hands. And I have to say, I know we're wrapping it up here, but, you know, we have some big problems in the country. The President of the United States was elected even after 60-something million people voted for the current president, even after allegations of his allegations of sexual violence and certainly a long history of misogynist public statements. So if we're going to try to change the accountability, but yet millions of people are willing to look the other way for various reasons, it shows you how much ground we have to cover.
Jackson Katz is author of The Macho Paradox and co-founder of Mentors in Violence Prevention. We're tweeting out his TED Talk called Violence Against Women. It's a men's issue. Jackson Katz, good to talk with you. Thanks for this.
You too. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Listening right along with you to KUOW has been our friend, Seattle writer, New York Times columnist, Lindy West. Good to see you again, Lindy.
Good to see you too. Thanks for having me.
I want to talk at length with you. Just before we take a quick break and we talk more, any reaction to what you just heard from Jackson Katz?
I cosign. Yeah. You know, I was thinking about, do we need outpourings of shame and shameful confessionals from men? And I was thinking about how totally uninterested I am in reading those.
Yeah. Why?
I don't know. I don't want to hear about it. Like, I don't want to spend all my time shaming men and chasing men around. And it's not like feminists want all men to be fired. We want you to change your behavior. Just go change your behavior. Don't make me do a bunch more emotional work, like processing it with you. Ugh. No thanks.
Well, separate from you're not wanting, understandably not wanting to read it, would it be helpful for men to read men's confessions?
Oh, yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. You tell me. Would it be helpful?
I think so. I mean, the power of a story, as you well know, is just there's nothing else like it. It's one thing to say worthy words of principle, but mm-hmm. a story rules.
Yeah. And certainly I think reorienting what strength means. And sometimes, you know, strength is accountability and strength is taking responsibility for yourself and your actions.
Can we talk more in just a moment?
Absolutely.
On KUOW is The Record. Stick around. KUOW is The Record. I'm Bill Radke here with Lindy West, Seattle writer, New York Times writer, talking about, well, we were just discussing who talks about sexual assault and harassment and who doesn't, whose responsibility it is. We were just gabbing when the microphone was off about just another one of Jackson Katz's comments a moment ago, being that not only men, but women are invested in the idea of men's physical domination.
Yeah, I mean, we know that 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump. I think old entrenched systems are really comforting for a lot of people. And it's, you know, change is terrifying. And I think that relinquishing control can feel really safe. You know, Donald Trump is a very old fashioned, swaggering, patriarchal figure. And there are a lot of people who take a lot of safety and comfort in the idea that someone else will solve your problems. And I think that, like, totally unearned hyper-masculine hyper-confidence that he embodies is appealing to people who have a lot of fear and who don't know how to solve their problems. You know, the idea that you know, your dad's going to march in and fix everything is very, very appealing mm-hmm. to people, especially people who, you know, who are relatively better served by that system. You know, white women benefit more than women of color and, you know, heterosexual white women are relatively, I don't want to say safe because obviously we're here to talk about male violence against women. But, you know, you're at least, it's safer to be close to the enemy. The enemy sounds so melodramatic, but do you know what I mean? Like, it's like if you realize that you live in a world where violence against you is normalized, I think cozying up to the people enacting that violence seems like a safer option.
Yeah, yeah.
Not to psychoanalyze millions of people, but just my best guess here.
Well, what do you think of, Lindy West is the author of the book Shrill, by the way. What do you think of the hashtag Me Too that's in millions of tweets? Because a moment ago we were saying you didn't want to read male confessionals. I wonder what you think of women saying, you know, putting a hand up, Me Too.
I mean, it was incredibly powerful. You know, I've been a longtime proponent of personal storytelling as a engine of change and empathy. And so, of course, it was heartbreaking and very, very intense to read, and not just to read about people's experiences, but to get a sense of the number of people close to you who have not just been suffering, but really figuring out a way to thrive and be productive, powerful people, even with that level of violence and marginalization. It's really, really, I mean, talk about strength. It's really powerful and inspiring. But, you know, I also feel conflicted about the way that we demand these mass confessionals every few years. You know, we had the same thing happen around Cosby. The same thing happened a year ago with the Access Hollywood tape and Trump. And it's there's something kind of lurid about it. I feel like people really like consuming these stories as spectators and don't necessarily follow through and actually take action. And I think there's something we need to examine about that, you know, because it also manifests just anytime, you know, I see if a woman comes forward with a rape allegation, people demand every single detail to prove, supposedly to prove that it's true. And to me, I think there's something sinister there, that there's some kind of entertainment value that people find in it, in picking apart other people's stories.
What would be a better version of Me Too?
Well, Me Too is a great version of Me Too.
Okay.
It's more the, I want people to examine their reactions to it, and their reactions more specifically to women who don't, or survivors who don't feel comfortable telling their story or telling, you know, opening up every detail of their trauma. I don't think that survivors should feel obligated to do that, to share the most painful moments of their lives. We should be working to fix the system that demands that of them. And also just our own expectations. Like, think about it. You know, if you hear that, if you read a news story about a rape or an assault or some sort of horrific crime, especially sexual violence, if there aren't all the details of that crime in there, do you feel ripped off a little bit? Do you feel disappointed? You know, I think a lot of people do, because we treat especially violence against women as entertainment. And I think people need to examine their own motives. And obviously, personal storytelling is really cathartic and really powerful. And I am so thrilled for people who feel empowered by Me Too. And I do, too. I mean, it's definitely a moment of solidarity that is very, very invigorating. But you know, it's...
I think I scan a story like that for clues about what I could do or how I could feel, what I could learn, what I could realize that I didn't know. I think that's what I'm looking for. And I never know whether those are also going to be harrowing or not harrowing. I don't know. That's their story, and I haven't read it yet.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I'm not condemning everyone who's participating in the hashtag and reading the hashtag. I just think there's this idea that that the solution here somehow is going to, there's going to be some critical mass of survivors ripping their lives open and letting you like autopsy the worst thing that's ever happened to them. And then eventually somehow that's going to change these entrenched systems of power. It's not. It's just, it's sort of turning sexual violence into a spectacle that, and I don't mean that to condemn the hashtag. I just mean the way that we consume it, I think, deserves attention.
Yeah.
And is part of the problem.
You wrote a New York Times column about sexual abuse that ran with the headline, "Yes, this is a witch hunt. I'm a witch and I'm hunting you." One of the great headlines. That was in response to Woody Allen warning against a witch hunt atmosphere when it comes to sex abuse accusations. What did you mean with that headline?
I mean, Woody Allen and everyone else. I mean, God, how many... I've heard the term witch hunt so many times throughout my career, not just about sexual violence, but basically anytime anyone criticizes any man, or especially if there are going to be consequences, like, oh, a man's going to be fired? It's a witch hunt. And so I, you know, just in time for Halloween, I thought, you know, the idea that it's a tragedy for men to feel, for predatory men to feel afraid that something's going to be taken from them, especially a professional opportunity when a huge part of what we're talking about involves women being pushed out of professional spaces by these by sexual predation and harassment. Oh, God forbid you feel threatened for a minute. And so, it's funny to me. I got so much backlash from that headline. I mean, I knew I would, but what people are arguing against is hunting sexual predators. You know what I mean? How can you be against that?
So when you say, yeah, I'm a witch and I'm hunting you, what do you mean?
Even though men control the levers of power in this country and in the world, victims do have some power. You know, women, just by naming their abusers, have created a huge, this sort of explosion of panic and consequences. You know, people are losing their jobs and people are losing the public trust. And so I just mean, you know, I'm not going to stop. You could say there's a little bit of magic there, you know, that your perpetrator's name is a magic word that creates a consequence.
Well, as you know, the witch hunt analogy, when I think of a witch hunt, I think somebody who is, it's a false allegation against somebody who is presumed guilty. So the witch would be the male victim in that analogy.
I know, I'm reclaiming it.
Yes, you're reclaiming the word.
I'm reclaiming it and I'm flipping it because it's absurd. I mean, you know, the idea that powerful men are somehow the victims of mob rule. Like, no, you rule the mob. Like,
right.
Yeah.
False allegation, not your top concern.
I mean, it's just like it's not statistically significant.
Yeah.
The reality.
Even the word false is sort of mis. Aren't we mostly talking about disputes about consent? Is that what this comes down to?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really complicated. I mean, I was born in the early 80s, and I was raised on movies where it was a totally legitimate plot point for boy, like. You could make a whole movie about teenage boys trying to figure out how to trick a woman into having sex with them or how to incapacitate her so that they could, you know, have their fun times with her.
Well, when I was coming up, it was the idea that the woman is going to feel like she's supposed to say no.
Yeah.
It wasn't about coerce. It wasn't about rape. It was about you know, just this is how the makeout session goes. I'm just telling you that was the pervasive culture when
sure.
I was coming up.
So that's a thing you hear over and over, that, you know, times have changed and there used to be different expectations. And you know, at this point, there's just no excuse for not having caught up. I mean,
yeah.
I've been a full-time feminist writer on a national level for over 5 years, and I came into a scene that had already been a movement that had already been talking about this for decades. So sorry, the information has been out there, and I don't really take, you know, I don't believe that every man who came of age in the 60s and 70s was just constantly preying on women. I don't think that that's true. I think that that's a self-serving excuse. So I forget where we started with this. Oh, it's just a complicated conversation because you do have people, you have men, you know, men are socialized in this system the same way that women are, and men are socialized to have to feel some entitlement to women's bodies. And I think it's a complicated system to dismantle, but that doesn't take away the accountability, because we know that women are human beings and we know that women deserve sexual consent. And so, you know, it's I'm tired of yeah. having this conversation.
Yeah. I understand.
Not with you. I mean, this conversation's
thanks.
Fine.
before we leave Witch Hunt, by the way, I understand that there are actually, you joked about Halloween, but there are apparently actually Lindy West Halloween costumes.
Oh, yes. I'm
up.
Being tagged. I'm being tagged on Instagram.
Yeah.
In people's sex predator witch hunt costumes, I guess.
Wow.
Oh, and I guess I remember what we were just talking about that I was trying to circle back to. Of course, false allegations of any crime are already a crime.
Yeah.
Like, I, you know, but it's just, it's a like a red herring that
yes.
this is any part of this conversation. The reality is that the justice system, the percentage of rapists who actually see some kind of consequence is minuscule.
Yeah.
So that's a much more, that's the problem that I'm interested in addressing.
There can be so many reasons women don't name names. Do you think any of those reasons is likely to change? Do you think that you're talking about in the Me Too, there were often stories with no name attached, no accusation attached. Do you see that changing?
I mean
with Harvey Weinstein, obviously.
Yeah, you know. I mean, that's contingent on the system changing. That's why Me Too is not the solution, and that's why it is men's responsibility to get involved, because there are all kinds of still all kinds of consequences. More, I would say more consequences for naming your perpetrator and for being labeled, you know, a troublesome woman than for being accused of sexual harassment. I mean, we still have a million excuses for why it's okay to harass your employees or to have harassed them 20 years ago or whatever. And I think that it's still a big, really, really big risk to name your perpetrator. And so that's not going to change until, you know, we have some sort of gender parity in positions of power.
Do you think it's important that a conservative, the former Fox News host Megyn Kelly, is talking about, you know, is naming Bill O'Reilly and the former Fox CEO Roger Ailes?
It's definitely important. And I think, you know, like Me Too, it's been a moment where conservative women and left-leaning women can find this common ground. But my hope is that it'll be an eye-opening moment for conservative women that, you know, these things that feminist women have been talking about all these years and being, you know, facing some pretty serious consequences over, some pretty serious punishments, you know, social repercussions are real. And to me, I just, obviously this is a long, slow process, you know, changing people's minds is very, very slow and very complicated. But to me, I just hope that it's the beginning of some kind of domino effect. Because once you start to realize, oh, okay, feminism isn't some sort of, you know, bizarre conspiracy to destroy men. And in fact, I've been through these things too. The feminist movement has been here trying to do something about sexual violence for a long time. You know, once you get there and you start to think, okay, I'm a person who identifies as a feminist and I believe in freedom and autonomy for all women and, you know, equality, then you get to this point where, oh, now I have to, if I believe in freedom and autonomy for all women, then I have to be, I have to fight racism. I have to dismantle racist systems and I have to dismantle homophobic systems and I have to dismantle transphobic systems because Black women are women, women of color are women, and LGBT women are women. And so it becomes this kind of domino effect where, you know, I guess I've been hoping that Megyn Kelly and Me Too could be a sort of gateway drug to intersectional feminism for women on the right, because it's, you know, it's bad out there. And, you know,
maybe Megyn Kelly's doing some hard thinking these days.
I hope so. I mean, Megyn Kelly has done some really, really bad stuff, and I don't really have a lot of interest in redeeming Megyn Kelly. That's Megyn Kelly's job. If she wants to, you know, apologize for, especially to the Black community, for a lot of the stuff that she said has said in her career on television. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a powerful moment of reckoning for a lot of people. And it's kind of, I'm curious to see where it goes.
Here we are talking about Megyn Kelly, talking about a woman again. Is there a, in the time we got left, is there a man, are there men that you want to call out as being role models right now? When I was a kid, when Alan Alda was sort of a feminist, I don't know if you remember, yeah, Alan Alda in the Free to Be You and Me and all that. He was
my favorite album.
Isn't that great?
I still listen to it.
Really?
On Spotify.
Oh,
it's,
man.
It's not embarrassing. It's because it's for babies.
If you don't know Free to Be You and Me, go do yourself
go check
a favor,
out.
By the way.
Yeah,
Run, Don't Walk. who's the modern Alan Alda?
Oh, God.
Or is that a ridiculous question?
I mean, Alan Alda's, I'm just going to go with Alan Alda.
Yeah,
Alan Alda's still alive, right?
But that's what I mean. I mean, that's sad, isn't it, that we're making a 70s reference or early 80s?
No, whatever? I'm sure there are new Alan Aldas. I don't know.
You want to go listen to William Wants a Doll together?
Yes.
Have a drink?
I do.
Okay.
Oh, my God. I cry every time.
Well, you know what? It's all right to cry.
I know.
I believe is track number 7.
Oh, my God.
Something like that.
See? It has a song for every emotion.
It absolutely does. By the way, there's a modern day version of It's All Right to Cry. It's by, I want to say it's by a guy in Hootie and the Blowfish or something like that.
Oh, boy.
But it's good.
Hootie?
Hootie. It might be Hootie. No, it's another one of those. But yeah.
One of the Blowfish?
Well, it's one of the fish. Yeah.
Wow. I did not know that one of the Blowfish released a cover of It's All Right to Cry. Thank you for that information.
Well, something like that. Someone's tweeting at us right now at KUOW. Lindy West. Anyway, my point is, it's always good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Lindy West, New York Times columnist, Seattle writer, author of Shrill. Come back again, okay?
Anytime.
Okay. See ya. KUOW is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle has such a dynamic art scene, a successful pop music industry, avant-garde theater, so much more, far more than a lot of cities of the same size. Well, you can give some of the credit to a piano teacher named Nellie Cornish. She moved to Seattle after the Gold Rush, founded a school that has shaped generations of artists. KUOW's Marcy Silman has more in this installment of City of Dreams.
This is a portrait of Nellie. I'm going to put it over
here.
Bridget Nolan has just unwrapped a yellowed photo of Nellie Cornish. You see a middle-aged woman with graying hair and wire-rimmed glasses.
From what I understand, she's about 5'3". She's kind of round and plump.
Not how you envision a radical arts educator. Nolan is the visual arts librarian at Seattle's Cornish College of the Arts, the school Nellie Cornish started more than a century ago.
I talk to her on a regular basis, just chat about what's going on here and how things are going. And
every year, hundreds of aspiring artists from around the world enroll at Cornish College to study music, dance, theater, and more. College media specialist Mark Bocek says Nellie Cornish got her start as an arts educator in Blaine, Washington, around 1892. She was 16 years old.
She noticed that one of the girls was, you know, giving piano lessons in a church basement for 25 cents an hour. And she said, I'm better than her. So she started going door to door, asking people whether they wanted to take piano with her for 50 cents because she was that much better.
Bocek has spent the past 5 years researching Nellie Cornish's life and legacy. He says young Nellie dreamed of becoming a concert pianist, but soon realized she didn't have the training or the talent. In 1900, she left Blaine to make a new life for herself in Seattle. This was still a rough-and-tumble frontier town.
It was lumber. It was pulling ore out of the ground. It was fishing. It was supplying, you know, guys to go to the Yukon. And those guys weren't much interested in art.
Right after the gold rush, Seattle didn't have much homegrown culture. Some private music clubs that held drawing room concerts, a few places that presented touring shows. Nellie Cornish set up a piano school in a building full of music teachers. But Bocek says she wanted to do more than just teach a child how to play the piano. She wanted to mold an artist.
A real artist. And what place does music and art have in a person's life?
Cornish left Seattle to find some answers. Her search led her to Calvin Brainerd Cady, a disciple of progressive educator John Dewey. Cady believed that every child deserved an education that included the arts. That was a radical idea, but Nellie Cornish embraced it. She came back to Seattle and she set up a music school.
We opened our doors on November 14, in 1914, in the Booth Building on Broadway and Pine.
That's Nellie Cornish in a 1938 recording. The Booth Building, the home of her first school, is still right here at the southeast corner of Broadway and Pine on Capitol Hill. The venerable Egyptian Theater is just to my west, and the Broadway Performance Hall at Seattle Central College is kitty-corner across the street. This neighborhood is still a dense cultural center. Within a couple of blocks, you'll find Velocity Dance Center, 12th Avenue Arts, and Elliott Bay Bookstore, to name just a few. Originally, Nellie Cornish's school was just for children, but as her students got older, her school grew with them.
I think we were the first ballet, and I'm sure we were the first theater school on this coast.
Cornish didn't really have a master plan. If she met intriguing artists from the Ballet Russe or theater pioneers from back east, she'd invite them to come teach at her school. Mark Bocek says the painter Mark Toby found her.
He'd heard tell that there's a woman in Seattle, you know, who would help young artists. And so he traveled from Chicago on a train with a buddy and a thing of apples to see if he'd be taken in at this school. And she said, sure, why don't you start the art department?
By 1921, the school had attracted hundreds of students. It outgrew the Booth Building, so Cornish and her board of trustees raised money for a new home, Carey Hall, on Capitol Hill's North End. The landmark building still houses the school's music and dance programs. On a recent morning, sun streams through the big windows in the dance studio on the top floor of Carey Hall. Out in the hallway, posters advertise everything from jazz ensembles to student art shows.
It's just been this place that has consistently produced people who know their stuff and have a respect for the art form and an enthusiasm for their participation.
Like so many Seattle area artists, dance writer Sandy Kurtz has worked at Cornish on and off over the years. She says the school maintains a hold over its alumni, including the late choreographer Merce Cunningham.
And whenever he was in town, if he had the time, he wanted to come and speak to kids at Cornish. And whenever he did, he really wanted to be in Miss Cornish's apartment.
Kurt says Nellie Cornish was able to create this kind of school in part because Seattle was so far from the East Coast.
When Cornish was founding this place, she was someplace no one knew about. And it was a time when there were very few authorities. She could do this because there wasn't really anybody around to say no. And that was magical.
At least 100,000 people have passed through Cornish over the past century, according to college records. Many, like Cunningham, actor Brendan Fraser, and singer Mary Lambert, went on to international fame. Thousands of others stayed in the Northwest, making art and teaching new generations of students. Mark Bocek believes Seattle's arts community would not be as robust without a visionary like Nellie Cornish.
She made a family out of artists in the Northwest, and I think that's what people respond to.
I'm Marcy Silman, KUOW News.
Who do you think's had a creative impact on Seattle? We want to know. Go to KUOW.org/City of Dreams to let us know. Finally, I was talking with Lindy West a moment ago, trying to think of who redid the Free to Be You and Me song, It's All Right to Cry. Originally, I think it was Rosie Greer. But anyway, the version that I'm thinking of was Hootie and the Blowfish Guy, Darius Rucker. It's on a CD called For the Kids. Now you know. Thanks for joining us.